Okay, so I'm going to talk, in fact, about two things. One is, as Anastasia said, the evaluation of what we call bibliometrics, the measure of publication activity. And the other one is the rankings of universities, because these things are tied in a sense. Now, I have a question for you. I see a number of people who are coming from France here, but those who come from abroad, how did you pick coming here?
Hello.
Ta-da! Apparently, you are supposed to answer.
Well, I mean, yeah. Also for people who are not from this university.
Yeah, why did you stay here?
that's the only place in the region where you have a master in human-computer interaction.
Okay, you wanted to stay close to home.
Also, it was well-run.
It was well-ranked. Aha. Okay, that's where we're going. Okay. What is well-ranked?
There is like a university ranking.
Yes, I know. I'm going to talk about it. So it was well-ranked from your perspective. Okay. And so...
Yes. So exactly in which aspect are you asking about?
How did you pick to come here in this university, in this program?
That this is more related to image processing.
Okay.
Because I mean human-computer interaction.
Okay, so it's a topic that drove you.
Image processing before, so yeah. I think it could have a relationship between. So I.
Okay, but you can do that in many other places in the world, or even in France. So.
Yes.
How did you pick? You tossed a coin. Someone told you about here, or.
Yes, I have friends in Paris-Saclay, and I heard of them, reputation.
Okay. So it's word of mouth and reputation. Okay, good. So is this going to work? Yes, amazing. So one of the things I want to talk about here is what does it mean to evaluate research? Anastasia and me, we are civil servants, so we are paid by the taxpayers' money, your parents' taxes, soon yours. And if you're working for a private university or for, say, R&D center, someone is paying your salary. So the notion of are you doing good research makes sense. So how do we evaluate research? In our business, the things we produce, we produce students, but we also produce papers in terms of research. So what is a good paper? What is a good journal to publish or a good conference to publish our work? What is a good project? A student who's doing a master's program wants to do a PhD. How should he or she, there are not many she's here, pick a project or lab, a university to go to? And what does good mean? When I started this journey through research as a student and started to be on committees who were hiring people, we were typically looking at how long the list of publications was. And more publications was better. Things have changed since then. And in fact, we've started to look not only at how many publications you have, but how good they are in terms of impact. What is impact? That's a subtext of what does good mean. Now, the thing that will come again and again in this presentation is that research breakthrough, things that have a very high impact, are rare and therefore hard to predict. So we are in a business where looking at means or averages does not make much sense because as we'll see, all the distributions we deal with are typically reverse exponential distributions. And that makes it counterintuitive, in a sense, to evaluate research. So the first part of this is going to be about bibliometrics. So bibliometrics is about measuring metrics, publishing activity. So the goal here is to measure the impact of publications, the impact of one publication relative to others, the impact of the publications of one particular researcher among others, if you are up for tenure or want to get hired, but also impact the publications of an entire group or even university. And the main metric that the people have found was meaningful in that respect was the number of citations. Not the number of publications per se, but how many times these publications are cited. And sometimes you can have people who publish many papers, but with little impact. Impact is typically number of citations. And people who publish few papers with much higher impact, which is the best. Now, there's two main derived metrics that are used in hiring committees and various evaluation contexts. One is called the H-index, which is typically to measure the impact of one person, and the impact factor, which is used to measure the impact of a journal or a conference, which is useful if you want to publish your work. If you go for a high-impact journal, it doesn't mean it will mechanically be cited more, but given the hundreds, thousands of publication venues that we have now, people, you know, I cannot look at everything published in HCI. Even, you know, if I ask my students to help, there's too many things. So we look at the ones we consider the best. And for all these things, you have these kind of things where you tend to cite papers that are published in the main venues, and the people who have the highest impact are publishing in those venues. So it's sort of a self-reinforcing system. So have you ever heard of the H-index? Yes? Okay. So the H-index was created by Mr. Hirsch, who's a physicist, who decided that number of citations alone was not sufficient to assess impact, and number of publications was not sufficient either. So he invented this index that combines the two. Here it goes. You take each of your paper published. I'm looking for the H-index of one person here. So I look at all the publications of one person, and I rank them, order them, by decreasing number of citations. So the first paper is the one the most cited, the second one the second most cited, etc. So I typically have a curve like this because you have everybody has a few paper highly cited, and then goes down, and then there's a long tail. And then you draw the diagonal here. Normally the two intersect. Well, they wouldn't intersect if you have very few papers cited very many times. That never happens, unless you're Albert Einstein. And so usually the two intersect, and that's the H number. So the H number is N. If you have N papers that have been cited at least N times, but the N plus one paper has not been cited N plus one times. See? Okay. So what does this mean? Publishing a lot more is not going to help, because you're going to have a longer tail if they're not very cited. Having a few papers very, very heavily cited is not going to help either. So you need to both publish more and have your main papers more cited more often. Now, the thing with this index is there are a number of properties. Is first of all, it increases over time. In fact, it increases even after you've stopped publishing, because people can still keep citing your papers. But what that means is that you cannot use it really to compare someone who's looking for a job at age 25 or just finishing their thesis and someone who's been in the business for 25 years. Because, of course, even if the younger person has had high impact, the older person would have had more time to gather citations. So the H-index is an interesting measure, but it's also very different when you go from discipline to discipline. There are disciplines like high-energy physics or biology, where papers have many authors, where the cycle of publication can be quite short. And there are other fields like mathematics, where you know, it lives on a different rhythm with typically fewer authors per article. So comparing the age indexes of two people who have even the same, we talk about research age, not their biological age, but research age is typically a number of years since the PhD or since you started graduate studies. So even if you compare two people with the same research age, they may have very different age numbers because their fields are working differently. If you work in a small field, you have less opportunity to be cited than if you work in a large field. So this is, in my opinion, a reasonable thing to look at, among others, when you're comparing things that are comparable, people with the same research age in the same field. Now, Hirsch did a study of the age numbers of people who had received Nobel Prizes, and so we got this curve. Now, the thing that's interesting is, so this is the number for each value of the age index, number of Nobel Prizes to people who had this age index. And so, you know, an age index of 75, that means you've published 75 papers. Now, you know, whole career, that's not insane. I mean, I've published close to 200 at this point. But, you know, there's a long tail there. My age index, we'll look at it, is around 40. I don't know if I'll ever reach 75. But what's interesting is a lot of people have had Nobel Prizes for having an age index, you know, say around 35 and 40, which is not that high. So it's not a sufficient measure of quality. You're not going to give the Nobel Prize to someone based on their age index, obviously. And we'll see another example of this. The other thing is, if you look, so the curve I had before was your number of citations per paper, which goes like this. Now, if you look at the number of researchers, number of citations, yeah, that's this curve here. So you see for a particular researcher, I don't remember who this was, doesn't matter, you have one very highly cited paper more than 100 times. Here we are at 70-something, 60, then we're around 45, and then there's this long tail. So this is a typical curve we're dealing with. And the problem is that if you have several curves like this, comparing them, it's not just looking at the mean. The mean will not mean anything. We did this exercise a number of years ago where our university was being considered for a research network in computer science called Digiteo. And we were asked to provide the age indices of people in the network, so from the various labs that are on campus here. And so I've removed the names here, but this is the curve we got. So we had one researcher who had an age index of 55 at the time. That I can say, it's Serge Abitboul, who is a famous database researcher. Then there were two at 32. Then, you know, we are in the 25, 20, and boom, it levers here, and we have the bunch at 10, and et cetera. In fact, if you look at the age indexes on this population, the number who had an age index between 20 and 60 was under 10, between 11 and 20 was over 40, and between 5 and 10 was over 70. So again, we get this an even, in a sense, distribution. For a while, John Palsberg had a robot that could query Google Scholar to create the distribution, calculate how many people had an age index of a certain number. But since he was hitting Google Scholar, at some point they blocked him, so you can't do that anymore. But you get the exact same curve. The majority, large majority of people have an age index of 2. That's typically going to be a PhD student who's published 2 papers and then goes on to do something else. And then you see it goes down, and if you look at 40, 50, it's really very minimal. Now, that means that if you have someone with a certain age number in there, what does it mean? Well, the problem is we don't know the age of these researchers. So we're not doing the thing I said we should be doing, which is to compare people Well, here we could say they're in the same field, computer science, even though across computer science there are also very different types of publication practices. Some areas are a lot closer to mathematics. Some areas are a lot more engineering oriented. But we're not comparing people with the same age. So let's look at something else. So this is now even a narrower field, which is HCI. Now, I think HCI is kind of a decent size field to look at things. So this table on the left part, I mean the main part, was done by Scott McKenzie in 2005. He collected the H indices, of the members of the ACMC Chi Academy. So the Chi field, hello. So human-computer interaction in ACM is called Chi, computer-human interaction. They put the computer first. I won't comment on this. Well, they argue it's pronounceable, so we say Chi. But anyway, so SIGCHI, a special interest group on computer-human interaction, has created in 2001 what they called an academy. And every year, they induct around 7 people who are seen as prominent people in the field to populate this academy and sort of be the luminaries, in a sense, or the leaders, or whatever you want to call them. So it started in 2001, and here I've listed the first 3 years. And so Scott looked at their H indexes. Now, what I find is that it's very interesting. The first inductee was Tuchard, famous researcher, at the time an H index of 44, which was high because I looked, in fact, yesterday night in Google Scholar, the current H indices of these people. So between 2005 and 2019, it's grown from 44 to 89. 89 is quite impressive, right? There's even more impressive. Ben, our dear Ben Schneiderman, is, according to Google Scholar, the most highly cited person. He has an H index of 117. He's retired, and so he's been there for a long time. He already had the highest one in 2005. But there are interesting things. At that time, Bill Buxton, who's another prominent person, had an index of 15 only. Doug Engelbart, the one, he's the one, right, had an H index of 11. The thing is, Engelbart worked at SRI, was not really supported by his institution, was always fighting to get his research funded and all that, didn't publish that many academic papers. In fact, we never cite, I don't think I've ever cited something published by Engelbart, except maybe the paper on augmenting human intellect was published in a quite obscure conference. But you see other people, Lucy Suchman I talked about in class situated action, 10. It's grown to 46 since then. So, you know, these people, I think, you know, we know most of these people, they deserve to be there. You know, they've had great impact on the field. But that impact is not always translated into a number of publications or number of citations. Some of these people have had, Lucy Suchman is an anthropologist originally. She has published her thesis as a book, and that book is very heavily cited. But she has not milked the cow, as we say, to get a bunch of papers published after that, which could have been cited. So to summarize on the H index, publication practices are very different from one subdiscipline to the next. And in fact, one thing I've observed is that since the H index has become something of interest to people who evaluate us, evaluate you if you go into research, people are playing the H index game. Well, that comes up later in another slide, but you know, in science, when you measure a phenomenon, you change the phenomenon, right? So if you tell me you're going to be assessed, evaluated, your grants or the funding of your lab will be tied to this number. Well, I'm going to look if I can make it better. So how would you make your H index better?
You can create paper through which will do a state of the art to have a lot of citation, because people actually they cite the old paper, but they cite actually your paper.
Yeah, that's a very good point. State of the arts are very heavily cited. But, you know, you can do so many of them. So things as you have one paper cited a million times, it's going to only get it up one notch. Okay, you too.
You sort of encourage or even force people working in your lab to work on, like, trending topics instead of exploring opportunities.
Okay, so the choice of topic is indeed a key thing. Now you have to be careful, because if you work on the trending topic, it means a number of other people are doing the same. So are you going to be the better ones? So I think exploratory things are, if you're the first to do something, usually that's the one that gets cited a lot because it's the seminal work. But it's true that there are areas that are more likely to attract citations than others. So that's a second thing.
You make everybody in your lab cite your paper? Like you cite people from your lab so that your lab gets better?
Exactly. That's called the invisible colleges. You don't do it with your lab, because that's a little bit too obvious. But you have friends. And this is the one point I wanted to get at, because what I've observed, and I'm sure you have too, is the number of co-authors on papers over the recent years, over the past 10, 15 years, has gone way up in our main publication field, which is the CHI conference or the Tokai Journal. And this has two effects. The first effect is, you know, you go to a conference, you meet someone, you say, oh, you know, why don't we work on this, and you author a paper together. So you can grab names as co-authors that are, you know, more visible, because people cite also based on the perceived visibility of the person. And then you expect this person to do this to you in return, kind of thing. Or at least by collaborating, you know each other's work, so you're more likely to cite that person's work than someone else's. Now, that doesn't shock me, the fact that if it fosters more collaboration, all the better. There are papers when you see 15 authors, I have a hard time believing that they all had, you know, the same contribution. And in fact, there's something that is starting to happen in some fields, in particular the medical and biology research, where the list of authors is accompanied by the contribution of that author to the work. And there is even taxonomies out there of types of contribution. So I had the idea, or I brought the money, or I did the study, or I analyzed the data, or etc. And there's a whole series of roles, because something you may not know is the order of authors also is seen as important. Now, the first author is the first author, supposed to be the main author of the work. Is that always true?
No.
We put our students first author. Now, sometimes they had the idea, they did, you know, a lot of the work, and we helped. But sometimes it's really our idea that they helped develop, but we still give them first authorship. So in mathematics, the order is alphabetical no matter what, in many, many places. In fact, my son spent a year at NYU. He's, because he came from a French baccalaureate, he was a lot more advanced in math than a lot of the undergraduate students there. So his math teacher was impressed, offered him to work with him on a project. They worked together on some graph theory something, published a paper. Where he had, you know, a contribution, but not certainly the major contribution. It was not his idea. He ended up being first author, because my name starts with B. So that's math. Then there are areas where the real order of contribution to the paper is the first author, then the last, then the second to last. And if you're in the middle, really, you had not much to do with the paper. Yeah, no,
so
they're,
yeah. There are conventions even inside a lab, yeah. Not even, you know, in a domain.
Can I
dates sure. index. One way to beef up the dates index is self-reference. So you create paper, easier than kind of having even your network. You just write papers and you cite yourself, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so citing yourself, so there are some versions of the Etch Index that are calculated by omitting self-citations. It tends to, except for a few authors who are really playing that game, it tends to be quite similar ranking. The numbers go down, but they go down for everyone. Yes?
Is there a metric like the Etch Index, but which is a bit more complex in the sense that it takes into consideration how different are the people?
I'll get to other indices. It's the next slide. So yeah, the thing is, through these invisible colleges, you can actually, and having more authors per paper typically helps everyone. And so I think this is an element that people have integrated into their publishing practices. As I said, it always increases, so it makes sense to compare only for people with similar age. It's very sensitive to the quality of the data. Google Scholar, which is the source that most people use, is quite noisy. It's really trying to get everything it can, so sometimes it indexes. Well, when you have people with the same names, it's not always good at making the distinction. When there are people with complicated names like mine, people do misspelling in the citing, it does not count those. Also, it counts things that are what we call the gray literature, technical reports, things that have not been peer-reviewed. So if you look to another source like Scopus, which is another standard source, the numbers, again, are lower than in Google Scholar. So people like Google Scholar because the numbers are higher, so they all feel better. But again, the ranking tends to be very similar. So, to say it again, can be used at best to compare researchers with similar seniority in the same sub-discipline even. Now, of course, people have thought, well, because there's all these problems with the H-index, can we invent something more fair, in a sense? So to fight the number of co-authors thing, you can normalize each paper by the number of co-authors. So instead of one citation counting one for all of the co-authors, if you have n co-authors, it counts 1 over n for each. So there is the m index, that is the h index divided by the scientific age. But that's problematic because it assumes that you can have a regular production over your scientific life, which is just not true, sorry. The G index uses an average number of citations. I never understood this one because I don't know what they average over. C index is accounting for quality of citations because people say, well, you know, sometimes you cite a paper in a negative way, so this shouldn't count. But how do you assess quality? That's a whole other question. There is an E index that ignore citations. I don't remember what this one was. My point here is if you have a name that doesn't start with H, M, G, C, or E, you should create your own index. I think I should create the B index and throw something else at it. I think the idea, and we'll see that for impact factor, we'll see it for ranking, the idea that you can capture the quality of research by one number is just elusive. Just makes no sense. So, now what I see more and more in hiring committees or in other contexts is, yes, we look at the H index, and we look if it sounds, quote, normal for that person in that context, or sometimes when it's very high, it can also make us suspicious. So you look more carefully at where the person is publishing, who is he or she publishing with? Where are the papers cited? But there are other sources of information to assess quality. And the reason I think it's very difficult to compare things is, again, getting back to these parallels. 20% of journals cover 80% of interesting articles. So if you look at the distribution, if you look at all the journals that are published out there, and again, there are thousands of them, in computer science, there are hundreds of them, You look the where articles are being cited, it comes from a very small number of papers. You have a large number of journals that I would call write-only journals. So it's papers, it's journals where you publish things that nobody reads. I'll get back to this. And 20% of the articles represent 80% of citations. So again, 20-80. Which means that even if you publish in a highly cited venue, conference or journal, only 20% of those papers are going to be highly cited. So again, you cannot apply, and I see this time and again, and it drives me crazy, especially from people who pretend to be scientists, to calculate averages or mean on distributions that are anything but normal. That's just not done. So that was the H index. Now I want to get to the impact factor, because that's sort of the other side of the equation, which is where to publish. The H index was, you know, what to publish so it gets highly cited, but the where to publish so it's more likely to be more highly cited is also an important question. And the thing that is going on behind the scenes here is that publishing has become a big business. If you look at the main publishers in the world, Elsevier and Springer Verlag, you look at the Forbes 500, there are companies who have a ratio of profit that is similar to insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies. They're even higher than companies like Microsoft, right? So it's a big business where in the recent, well, it's not so recent anymore, but starting around 2000, there've been massive concentration. Elsevier and Springer in particular have absorbed a bunch of smaller editors. A lot of people don't see that because they keep publishing under their original names, like Morgan Kaufman, et cetera, et cetera. Lawrence Elbrum. It's like when you buy detergent, you know, in the supermarket, you have all these brands, but in fact they all belong to Procter & Gamble or Unilever. But from your perspective, there are 10 or 15. In fact, there are only two. So the same thing has happened in commercial publishing. And for these companies to make their business, they have to advertise that they have the best journals. And their measure of success is the famous impact factor. So what's the impact factor? It's the number of citations of articles published in the last 2 years that are being cited in the current year. And you divide by the number of articles published over this past 2 years. So you take a slice of 2 years of a given journal, papers published in 2 years, you count in the following year the number of times these papers have been cited, and you divide by the number of articles. So it gives you the average number of times a paper has been cited 1 or 2 years after it's been published. And of course, it depends on which database you're using to count those citations. And so the impact factor was created by, under the name, the company called, what's the company? Anyway, it's called the ISI. And they only account for journals that they have indexed, which adds a problem, as we will see in a moment. So ISI publishes the JCR, the Journal Citation Report. This is an old one. I should refresh it. And if you look, you can look at it by topics, by categories. So this is computer science. So the highest cited at the time was ACM Transactions on Graphics, which is actually the SIGGRAPH conference. Journal of Semantic Web, Journal of the ACM, which has a lot of, it's not ACM surveys actually, but it has survey-like papers. Transaction and Software Engineering, Real-Time Imaging. And if you look at the impact factors here, 2.2. I've never understood why they put four digits. I mean, three digits after a decimal point seems a bit insane to me. But that means on average, if you publish a paper in the top journal, it will be cited within 2 years three or four times. Now, they have also a five-year impact factor, which they do the same thing over 5 years instead of three. So, of course, it's a bit higher, but not that much. So it's kind of amazing to me that, you know, a lot of the measure they have of impact of their journals is based on such small numbers and saying that, you know, transactions on graphics is ahead of semantic web because here it's 3.413 versus 3.410. When this thing's published, what, 20, 30, 40 articles a year in a journal, you know, it's not that much. Now, they have a whole other set of things here, the cited half-life, the eigenfactor. So you want numbers, you can find a bunch of numbers in there. What's the half-life? This one I always have trouble with. It's the number of years such that half of the journal's cited items were published more recently than the half-life. Okay. So here is the type of curve you have to deal with is, so this was typically done in 2008. They look at number of citations for papers published in 2007, 6, 5, etc. And here's the thing that I find interesting, is that the impact factor is computed with papers published over the last 2 years, these two. But if you look at the number of citations, you see that it peaks 4 and 5 years ago, which is normal because, I mean, to me, the impact factor literally means nothing if not that people are manipulating it, because to publish a paper in a journal takes between the time you submit it. It almost never gets accepted right away. So usually you get minor or major modifications, so you have to rewrite your paper, it's re-evaluated. Then once it's accepted, it goes into the production process where someone, well, doesn't retype it really, but does the editing. And then it finally gets published, and at the time where we still had paper publications, journals had a cap on the number of pages per issue they could publish. So sometimes it was there and staying in the queue for a year or two before it actually came out. So I don't understand how you can even have papers published on year N cited the next year. Because for you to have seen the paper and immediately cite it would still take at least a year for it to be published and count. And this is what this curve shows, is that, yes, you cite papers typically that are 3 or 4 years or 5 years old. And then you have also a tail. This is comparison of the age of citations of articles, and it says essentially the same thing. There, green is the total for the iCite database, and they look at two fields, molecular biology and biochemistry in blue and mathematics in red. And you see that, yeah, of course, year zero, although year zero is not zero. So this is a log scale, by the way, because here I have one, and here you can't see, but it says 10. And so you see your 0, your 1, your 2, your 3, so around 3 year, but since they start at 0, it's really 4, that you have the highest number of citations. So how did they get this kind of impact factor? So I got interested in this, and I published an article in CACM about this, because for a while I was involved with a journal in HCI that is from a commercial publisher. And it was interesting to see their practices. When you get a paper accepted, you get this note from the editor-in-chief saying, oh, by the way, it would be good if you added some citations in your paper about this and that work that happened to have published in the same journal a year or two ago. I also learned that people who are editor-in-chief in journals at commercial publishers like Elsevier and Springer get paid. Normally, all of this work is done for free. When you peer review a paper, when you're the editor, the associate editor, we all do this for free. But if you're the editor-in-chief, they either pay you directly or in other ways. And so what I discovered is there's this whole business going on to pump up the impact factors because it's such a critical thing for these journals. And in computer science, we're in particular bad shape because for a long time, this was in 2003, things have gotten better, but not so much. So this guy Mattern from ETH Zurich did an analysis of the coverage of the ISI database, which is used for computing those impact factors, the level of coverage of this database for the publications from ETH in these various fields. And you see that in physics, chemistry, biology, the proportion is around 60%. So not that good, I would say, but at least pretty high. And then there are fields like, well, architecture. I don't know what the second one is here. But informatics here, coverage 14%. That means 86% of the stuff we publish in computer science was ignored by this calculation of impact factors. And that's because in computer science, we publish mostly in conferences, unlike these other fields. These other fields have conferences, but conferences are posters or short papers. It's just for people to get together. It's not seen as the place where you really publish the work that will be cited. You do that in journals. So for many years, ISI refused to index conferences, even though in our field, the CHI conference is as prestigious as the top journals. Now, they fixed that since then. Partially, they have a very stringent process to accept to index something that is really biased against non-commercial publishers like ACM, IEEE, and other societies. Do you guys know about ACM and IEEE? Okay, so ACM and IEEE are professional or learned societies, as they're called. So they're not for profit. They publish proceedings, journals, magazines, but they're not in there for the money. Well, although in the case of IEEE, you could argue, but. So one of the things that he showed is that, yeah, in biology, these are, in the red thing here, is what's indexed by ISI. For biology, a lot of things are citing papers from journals that are indexed, whereas in computer science, it's much less the case. If you add the proceedings from ACM, IEEE, and LNCS, which is from Springer, but it's conference proceedings, it goes up to 50%, but still far from the 90% in biology where people are publishing in journals and citing journals. So why is that? As I said, ISI does not index conferences. And ISI is really selective. They belong to a commercial publisher, so they have an interest in getting non-commercial publishers out of the game. Which gets me to my rant about open access. So, just to warn you. So, as I said, scientific publishing has become a big business. For many years, publishers like even the big ones of today, Elsevier, Springer, were not publishing science as their main business. They were making money typically out of textbooks. The market for textbooks is kind of an amazing thing in itself. Because they sell, for example, they sell textbooks in the US for 10 times the price they would sell them in Europe because they are mandatory in the US. And for many years, you could not buy them, of course, abroad unless you travel to England or something. Now with e-commerce, things have changed. But for many years, scientific publishing journals was not a big business. And then suddenly, they started to see the shift happening. And it's a great business because all the job is done for free by people like us. We write the journals, the articles, we review them. We do the editing. In many cases, we publish the final, what's called camera ready, really ready to be printed or published in any way, electronic or other. So they don't have that much to pay for creating a new journal. And people are dying to be on editorial boards of journals because it looks good on their CV. So the impact factor has become a marketing argument for commercial publishers, who now, instead of selling individual subscriptions to journals, they sell packages. And every time you have these business practices, it's not good, because in the package, you get a few of the journals you like and a lot of stuff that is really not good. But they force you to take the package or nothing. And the prices have raised and raised and raised, 20% a year, 40% a year, to the point where now universities cannot afford these subscriptions. So in France, they created a national consortium called Couperin that negotiates with those publishers to have a deal on all the universities in France that are interested, or all the labs. And recently, discussions with Springer have not gone well, and I don't know what is the status actually at this point in time, but at some point, Springer said, well, you're not paying, we're not giving you access to all the stuff. And the thing is that now that everything is electronic, it's not that you still have your library with all the journals and you can look at the old issues. If you stop your subscription, you have no access to anything, even though you've paid for years and years very hefty amounts of money. Now, the reason this works is because universities or labs have to subscribe to these journals. If we don't, we don't have access to the literature. We cannot do our job. So the customers are the research institution that produce the research and read the research of others. So they're a captive audience, which is a very good situation for a company to, you know, take advantage of that and raise prices. So this became really problematic. And here came open access, where people said, well, enough of this. The results of research should be freely available to the world. After all, we here in France and in a number of European countries are paid by taxpayers' money. So what we do should belong to the people. And the thing is that it's a great idea. I think we should have open access to baguettes as well in France, right? No?
It's not paid by the taxes. I mean, it's not made.
Yeah, but I like baguettes. just kidding. The thing is, when people say open access, this movement came up at the time where all these digital libraries were becoming reality, where having to pay for stuff being printed on paper, put into the mail, and sent to hundreds of labs around the world became kind of insane when you had access with a click to that same document. But the thing that people missed in that thing is that it still has a cost. Because putting a PDF of your paper on your homepage doesn't cost much. Putting it in something like the ACM Digital Library costs a lot more money. Why is that? Oh, yeah, you, because?
Because?
Yes, and why does this cost them money? Okay.
They organize the conference.
No. Conferences make money.
Like with the physical place,
yeah.
It makes money.
Then oh, yeah.
Online services. Oh, yeah. Okay.
I mean, they have to manage a web server. So
that's what you wanted to say, too? Yes. The infrastructure to manage a digital library that has the ACMDL now has millions of references, it's not just the server's disk space. It's all the work it takes to index the papers, to make cross-references, to manage all the metadata, to ensure that it's reliable in terms of accessibility. ACM has a deal with two other organizations so that if ACM were to disappear tomorrow, if they went bankrupt, who knows, around September 11, 2001, the revenue from conferences went way down because people did not travel to conferences anymore, and it put ACM in big trouble. So even if ACM disappeared, they have deals for which, of course, they pay for, so that all of their digital library will be taken over by someone else, so it will be there forever. And all of this adds cost. And I've been on the ACM publishing board for publications board for a while, and at the time, that was in the early 2000s, they were paying around $1 million a year to maintain their digital library. And when I say this number, people go, oh, it's not possible. I can do that myself, you know. but no, it's a lot of work. It's still a lot of manual work that they subcontract.
And also hidden costs related to lawyers, for example, which you could guess that ACM has a bunch of lawyers in retainer for things like plagiarism.
Yes.
And
good point.
Publications that come up that are problematic ethically or in other ways.
Yeah, and that's another issue, which is a lot of people complain that they have to transfer copyright to the publisher when they publish a paper. Transferring copyright means that you are giving the publisher the right to do pretty much whatever they want with the paper in terms of republishing it, translating it, etc. But they also protect you against plagiarism, which is on the rise, and other things. And so it's a question of balance, and it's also a question of trust. Do you trust that organization to do its job well, or do you think you can do it yourself? But putting your papers on your homepage, you know, is going to be fine for as long as you're around, but one day you retire, and then your thing is not going to be there. So having it published somewhere is important. Yes?
Are there universities which take care of, like, looking out for plagiarism, for instance?
Yes.
For the people publishing there?
But there are things like translation, which is really hard to grab. Right. People grab articles, they add their name. So I know of several cases where the article was taken. I think this even happened here during a hiring committee. They added a name in a huge list of authors, and then they started presenting these papers as their own. This is one way of doing it. The other one is you take an article online, you translate it in a language that's a bit obscure, and then it's your paper. Right? Mm-hmm. Then you republish it. It's really hard to check.
It's a nasty world out there. So open access, great idea. Now, how do we make it work? Who's going to pay for this $1 million? So there's two approaches. One is called green open access, and the other is gold open access. Now, green open access is based on self-archiving and institutional repositories. So if you go to this site, sherpa.ac.uk/romeo, you have a list of publishers that are considered green open access. So ACM, since I'm talking a lot about ACM, is one of them. It does not mean that ACM is putting the papers accessible for everyone for free. ACM is authorizing you, the author, even though you have transferred them your copyright. They have different options now, but assuming you have given them copyright, they still allow you to do two things. Put a copy of the paper on your website. It's what's called an author copy. It cannot be the PDF of the digital library, but it's one where, well, typically you can have fixed a few more mistakes. It's the author copy. And they also allow you to put it on an institutional repository if your university or organization has one. So in France, there is one institutional repository called HAL, H-A-L, so you can also look it up. I should have put the URL in there. And for example, in our labs, we put all of our papers, all those that are published with green publishers into HAL. In fact, it's even required by our institution. Not really required, but when they evaluate us, they look at what's in HAL. They don't look at our webpage. So little incentive there. So that's green open access, and I'm a big fan of green open access. because I think it maintains the right balance of things. Now, the other model is called gold open access, which of course sounds, well, I don't know, is gold better than green these days? But gold means money, right? And gold open access is the model where, well, someone has to pay, well, let's charge the authors. Now, this is an interesting model because I usually hide the last line here and ask you how much you think it would cost to publish an article in one of these publishers. And I usually get numbers like, oh, 100 euros maybe. And no, the range is really, I mean, the classic numbers these days is around 1,500, sometimes less if you are a member of the society, for example, or but it can go up to 8,000. So Public Library of Science, PLOS, the famous open access publisher, what I find fascinating with them is depending on the journal, you have to pay more or less money. And that's something I don't quite understand. You know, if you publish a 10-page paper, why would it cost more money if it's in one journal rather than the other? There's something fishy, right? And it's the more prestigious journal that costs more. That's so strange. Now, the argument behind gold open access is, well, you know, your research is funded by grants, mostly. A little bit of public money, but grants, public money grants or industry grants, whatever. So these grants, they cover the cost of doing business. And our business is hiring people like PhD students. Our business is sometimes getting equipment in our field. It's not the most critical, but in other fields, it's really critical. And our business is publishing papers. So why don't we put the cost of publishing as, you know, one more line in the budget when we go for a grant? I think that could make sense, but, you know, there's one area in publishing where people pay to get published. You know what it's called? It's called the vanity press. Publication à compte d'auteur. That's the type of press where you cannot find an editor who wants to publish your work, so you decide to take your own money to publish it. It's not seen as really the best way to publish work, and it's certainly not the way to publish the best work. So why is it that scientific publishing should take as a model the vanity press, and why would it be the only area where people will have to pay to make their work available to others? You know, if I do a painting and I sell the painting, I don't have to pay to sell the painting. The person who's buying it is paying. So it's very weird. However, this model has caught on. Now, many funding agencies, I think ANR now, I'm pretty sure, but certainly the European funding agencies, the one, the national ones in the UK, the NIH in the US, National Institute of Health, all of these agencies require now that if they give you funding, the publications have to be published in open access, and they don't say whether it's gold or green. In EU project, in the template you get for the budget, there's a line for publications. So they anticipate, they accept, they expect that you will have a line to pay for publishing. I always put zero there because I go green, but I know a lot of colleagues who are putting a number in there because there are some fields like especially biology where what was called author charges for publishing in journals has been a practice for a long time. There was a time where publishing in journals where if you wanted color plates, as they call them, color pictures in your paper, you had to pay extra. And it was like 200 euros a page or something crazy. Now, the thing is, of course, publishers, the commercial publishers are not dumb. At first, they saw this open access and they thought, oh, it's going to kill our business here. And then they, you know, sit down and thought for a while. And they say, well, no, we're going to do something really great. We're going to do gold open access, but we'll still have the subscription model where you pay to get subscription to a particular journal or set of journals, so you get access to all of them. I mean, that's the best of both worlds, right? You charge both the readers and the authors who happen to be the same people. I mean, that's brilliant. I mean, you know, for someone with an MBA, it's like, yeah. Now, what really appalls me is that even ACM now is doing this. And I know people who fall for it. Because the model is, okay, your paper got accepted in this journal. It's going to be published. ACM is a green publisher, so you can put it on your web page. You can put it on the HAL repository if you're in France. And it says, well, if you want it available for free to everyone, you can pay, and then we'll make it open access to everyone. So you pay, in a sense, not to be published anymore, but to be visible to everyone, except those who need to access it already have access to it. Because everybody is subscribed to the ACM Digital Library, who's in the field of the ACM. And when they have this dual model, in fact, the number of people who pay for the gold open access is very small. I think for ACM, it was I asked recently, it was like 2-3%. But there are other people who have thought even further, who said, well, we're going to go for the gold open access without the subscription model. And these are called the predator publishers. And there is this link here, predatoryjournals.com. So these are publishers who came out of nowhere and give themselves big names, names that sound good. They typically go after new faculty. We've had the case twice in our lab. A PhD student getting a job, a couple of months later, is getting an email from one of these publishers saying, oh, would you like to be the editor-in-chief of your own journal? And in both cases, the students sent, either Wendy or me, a message saying, I got this email. This looks super interesting. So what these predator publishers are doing is they have a publishing model where they are getting people to be editors of their journals by pretending that they have the International Journal of HCI, which looks good, right? Except if you dig a little bit, this is completely unknown, and it's certainly not in the top journals. They have very quick revision cycle. Recently, I did the exercise. I was asked to review for one of these journals. I looked at the paper. It was really crap. I said, well, I'll review it. I'll accept to see what happens. And next thing I know is you have 1 week to review it. I negotiated to 10 days. I had already sort of skimmed the paper, and it was so bad it was not a hard review. I read a long review saying, you know, this is... And then after the reviewing process, I had access to the other two reviews, which were like 5 lines long. One was actually positive, saying, oh, very good work. The other was kind of, it's a bit like, you know, when you see reviews on Yelp or on TripAdvisor, people haven't really been to the restaurant, but write a nice review anyway. Now, I'm in a sense, I'm sad this paper was not accepted because in the end, I guess I wrote such a too good a review that they couldn't care to accept it. But the point is, these papers accept just everything, and of course, they charge the authors. And they make tons of money because even though nobody reads them, they don't care. Their business is towards the authors who are in need of publication. And, you know, when you are in institutions like Paris Sud, like the big universities, we all know about this. But there's all these other places where people don't know better, and they're being taken advantage of by these publishers. Okay, so that's the part I wanted to do on impact factors and publishing. Before we go to ranking of universities, which is another interesting collection of scams, you have questions about this? The reason I do this is because time and again I talk to colleagues and I'm always surprised at how naive some of my colleagues are about these things. And, you know, because we are scientists, we are in for the better good of humanity. We don't think that, you know, things can be done in a way to take advantage of us, of our reputation, of our money, in a sense. And I think it's important that, you know, you're aware of this.
Are there, like, discussions for putting the hosting costs on institutions or, like, national things like HAL?
Well,
ACM, and then ACM will, like, only reference those to, like, sort of split the bill?
So the thing is, well, first, HAL costs money, and that is covered by the institutions who contribute to HAL. It was started by CNRS, so it's mostly funded by CNRS, but now INRIA also participates and other institutions. The thing is, when I want to look for something, I don't go to HAL. I go to the ACMDL.
Yeah, but I mean, HAL hosts them and ACM could reference them.
Yes, but HAL hosts the papers by French authors. And when I'm looking for something, I'm interested in a field, in a topic. So I want to go to the publisher of the journals and papers I know in the area. And then usually by Googling the title of the article, I can find it on HAL if it's a French paper, or on Archive is another widely used one, and there are other ones.
So, I'm just saying, as an idea, it's great. You can imagine having HALs in every country, but that doesn't guarantee that every HAL has a consistency. You still have to maintain consistency across. You have to cross-reference, etc. So even that's a solution. The cost of having the server is not that much enough. So the consistency, keeping the consistency, I think would cost actually more if you had them distributed, to be honest. And you cannot trust all countries to have a fair treatment of publications in whatever way you want to call fair. It will not be consistent in any case across countries. So I don't. It's a great idea, but also HAL might disappear tomorrow, right? We might have a dictatorship in France, and suddenly all the publications that are stored, I'm just saying, right? In HAL just suddenly disappear. So that's the scientific community going down. So you know there are these considerations.
The thing is, there's also the issue of reputation. And the thing is, a repository, an archive, does not have the same role as a publisher. A publisher is picking the work they want to publish. That's why there are editors and all that. And you look at who is on the editorial board of this journal. HAL is just collecting things. In fact, in HAL, we can put our technical reports, and that's fine. Again, archiving and an archivist and librarian are two different types of jobs. So having said that, yes, there are standards that are emerging, so there's more interoperability, if anything.
I am also, so I think pretty much all of the researchers here are green access. This is, you know, and IEEE, for example, which makes money from conferences mainly, not publications, is also green access. All the major venues are green access.
Well, it's in their interest because as long as, in a sense, universities play the game and continue to subscribe to the digital library, which they do, again, because they cannot rely just on the institutional repositories. So ACM has this deal where if you subscribe as a consortium, you have a much lower price than if N universities subscribe separately. That's why France has created this Couperin organization that subscribe as a consortium to the ACM digital library, and all the universities that have a lab in computer science are automatically subscribed, which means it's taken care of at the government level, not off the university budget. Yep. Okay, let's talk about rankings a little bit. So, have you heard of the Shanghai ranking? Yes. The THE ranking? Yes?
Actually, Michelle, maybe you can mention CORE, the ranking of journals.
Oh, yeah. But I don't know, because it disappeared and it.
It has died now. So, that was an initiative like a few years, so I'll take 2 minutes.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Maybe 10 now ago. I think it started in Australia, to be honest. So, yes. There are biases there as well. So what it happened is there was a collection of academics that said, okay, instead of having all of these impact factors, what we'll do is we'll ask academics themselves to rate conferences and journals. And they created a ranking based on academics. So it's good, but there are also issues there. Can you guess what are the issues? I mean, it's a ranking I trust fairly. If I look at a new conference that I have no idea about, I check CORE always. But there is a problem there. Can you guess?
I suppose the Australian ones got.
So first of all, the panel of people who are experts starts from Australia. So there is a bias, let's say, towards Australian publications or the point of view of Australian.
This will be built like what already exists, and there already are some sort of biases. So like if the top universities already are in the U.S. and top publications.
Well, it's for publications.
It's for publications. It's a ranking of journals. Journals. And conferences.
You know, the first discussion on journals rather than universities. So the ranking comes in journals, yeah.
Maybe people that got refused somewhere then could take revenge and.
Well, you could hope.
If you have enough people, I guess that gets into the noise.
So the other
hopefully.
Thing is you kind of promote the publication venues you prefer, right?
Right.
As an academic, whoever you are. But again, if you have a big panel, you can assume that, you know, this kind of gets ironed out. So there is no perfect system. And also it means maintenance, right? Because every year people, you have to.
Because things change.
Yeah, so you have to vote as a consortium. We even have a local list like this in Paris Sud where the researchers here keep track.
Well, the thing is that we took the CORE ranking and then we said, oh, you know, here I disagree. And so
exactly.
We're going to
so
push this one up or this one down because it's not.
Extensions because they disagree with CORE.
But so, in fact, I was a director of LRI for a while, and that was when CORE came out. And for our evaluation, which was done at the time every 4 years, we gave a list of publications and showed in front of them the ranking in the original CORE and the one we had adjusted because we thought that it was not right. And this way, and to me that's the thing, is that, you know, if you're evaluated, give the information to the evaluator so they can make their own opinion. So, you know, by showing the two, we said, well, you know, this was our choice. Maybe you disagree and we can talk about it. But it's a good point because the reputation is going to come back here. So you've heard of the Shanghai ranking. So the Shanghai ranking is done based on 6 criteria. Now, if you look at this column, that's all good. Quality of education, quality of faculty, research output, size of institution. That was actually added after the first few years because the way they count these things was heavily biased towards big universities, and the small ones were disadvantaged. So they put that as sort of a corrective measure. Now, the thing is, quality of education is measured by the number of alumni who've had Nobel Prizes and field medals, which kind of narrows it down quite a bit, especially for computer science, where we have neither, so we don't count by definition. Quality of faculty, staff of an institution winning Nobel Prizes and field medals. Well, it's or, actually. You don't have to have won both, because that but there's also the highly cited researchers. So the same ISI, as we talked about earlier, has this ranking of highly cited researchers. They've divided science in 21 subject categories, and in each category, they looked at the most highly cited. I think it's over the past I don't know if it's 5 years or something like this. And so that's for 20%. By the way, when they say alumni here or staff, staff here is a great one because you don't have to have someone who's had the Nobel Prize or Fields Medals for work they have done at the university. You can buy them after they got the Nobel Prize by giving them a hefty salary and say, well, don't you want to finish your career with us here? So, and that, boom, counts there. Research output, articles published in Nature and Science. That's it. For 20%. And then the rest of it, ISI is back here again, another 20%. And then size of the institution, 10%. Now, all of this has one value, which is it's all based on measurable things. You can argue about whether it's as relevant as they say, but it's based on numbers. Now, if we look at the Shanghai ranking for the top 10, so I started doing this presentation back in 2004, so then I updated it in 2008, and then I updated it again yesterday. So 2000 to 2008, the top 10, Harvard, Stanford, Cambridge, Berkeley, MIT, Caltech, Princeton, Oxford, Columbia, Chicago. 4 years later, the same. Cambridge and Berkeley swapped. And then Columbia, Chicago went up, while Princeton and Oxford went down, but it's the same top 10. Now we fast forward 11 years. That's from yesterday. It's again the same top 10. Harvard, Stanford haven't moved. Now Cambridge and MIT have gone ahead of Berkeley. Berkeley is going down. Berkeley is public funding, so they have difficulties these days. Then the bottom part is more mixed up, but you get the exact same 10. Now, the thing is, this going up, going down business, when you look at the actual numbers, I didn't put it here, but their ranking is based on, we give the top 100, so whatever the numbers come out of these indicators, you normalize, so the first one is 100, and then we go down from there. Now, I find it fascinating that on a scale of 0 to 100, the first one is at 100. The second one, which is Stanford, which is no slouch, goes down, boom, to 75. 25 points down. By the time we are at the 10th, we are already at 55. And then, you have thousands of universities in line behind that. But even on this top 10, if you compare the numbers, not the ranking, it's very flat here. Here it goes down. Here it's very flat. So, the order of this four really does not mean anything, right? If you go on the same thing between 2008 and 19, so the second graph I showed, again, this four are really pretty much the same. Caltech has gone, I would say, significantly up. And the other ones, again, are indistinguishable. The thing is, once again, we get our favorite power curve, where this is the scores of the first 500 universities. Start 100, goes down to 75 and something, and then you have this long tail here. Now, I think France is the only place in the world where the Shanghai ranking is well known. I often talk to colleagues from other countries and ask them about Shanghai ranking. They've heard of it by now, but they don't really pay attention. In France, it was a major thing. And here's why. If you ask anybody in France, what are the top schools? What are the top universities? Because in France, universities and schools, So, what are you going to say? Well, you could say UNS first. It's okay. We don't, we don't mind. So, Polytechnique and UNS are seen as the top elite schools and universities, and then you would have, probably Centrale and other schools, and nobody would even mention universities, at least 15 years ago. And then, in the Shanghai ranking of universities, in 2004 to 2008, Paris 6, Jussieu, in the center of Paris, was the top one, ranked around 41. Paris Sud, us, was the next one, around 48. Strasbourg was at 82, but plunged in 2008 in the 100 to the 150. After 100, they don't rank them one by one. They do by batches of 50. And ENS Ulm was 85. And Polytechnique was not in the top 100. And that was a shock to the French intelligentsia. And they said, well, we have to do something about it. So let's see what happened since then. This is, again, from yesterday. So I put the 2008 one. So Paris Sud is now top French university. Ranks 37. Interestingly, Paris 6 has become now Sorbonne University, much bigger as aggregated schools and stuff. But they're gone down. Well, they've gone up to what they had before, but they are behind Paris Sud. So it's going to be interesting to see when Paris Sud becomes Paris Saclay, if we go up or down. We're predicted to be going up, but ENS has stayed around the same. And then in the 100 to 150, universities of Strasbourg, Aix, Grenoble, and Paris 7 have also entered the ranking. Still no Polytechnique, no École Centrale, no Télécom, no nothing of that. Now, the reason is that these schools, however good they are very small. And so given the fact that they use absolute numbers and the fact that the weight of the size is only 10%, it's really difficult to compensate for the small size. And it is the very reason why, for the past 15 years, our entire French university system has been in this big sort of progression towards putting together things that have been divided up in 1968. In 1968, there was the University of Paris, period. And then, because of the trouble in 1968, the students on strike and all that, the next government decided to split the universities into faculties, into smaller units. And that's why you had Paris 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., up to 13. You go to any city in France, you have Bordeaux 1, 2, 3, 4, you have Toulouse 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you have etc. And now we're doing it the other way around. We're putting these things back together and aggregating the engineering school, the Grandes Écoles, in the system to also, you know, get bigger numbers. And the transition from Paris Sud to Paris Saclay, which is going to be effective on January 1st, is exactly for that purpose. And they paid people to make projections of where we would be after this merge, in this ranking and that ranking and that other ranking. And interestingly, going bigger does not necessarily mean you're going up in the rankings, because, of course, you need to have good aggregate to good institutions together. So that's the Schengen ranking. Now let's go to, let's look at another well-known one, which is the Times ranking, Times Higher Education ranking. Now, it's interesting because here we get something different. Harvard is first. Okay, that doesn't change. Now, Yale is here. Okay. Now, Cambridge, Oxford are right next to it. Oxford was way below before. Caltech, we've seen before. Imperial and UCL, okay, they're in the top 10 now. It's interesting. Chicago was there. MIT was there. Columbia was there. Now, again, this was done in 2008. I looked at it again yesterday. Well, what's changed here is the order has changed. So now Oxford is top, ahead of Cambridge, which has stayed third. Stanford has entered. Thank you. Princeton as well. University College London has disappeared. And Columbia has disappeared from the top 10. I think it's right next. And there's been some pretty large changes. So Harvard has dropped to 7. It's like, what is going on? Now, would it help if I told you that Times Higher Education and QS, the company that does that, is based in the United Kingdom? I don't know. Just a hint. Now let's look at how they evaluate, how they make up their ranking. And that's where we get to reputation, because the top two, and they don't give the numbers, and in fact, they massage them from one year to the next. We don't know exactly what they're doing. The academic peer review, a global survey of academics asking respondents to identify universities they consider excellent in their own broad field of knowledge. Employer review, a global survey of employers with experience of recruiting from universities, asking respondents to identify universities they consider to be best at preparing their graduates for the workplace. This is what we call reputation. This is exactly what you're talking about, Core. Now, I'm a curious person, so once I guess I become important enough to be one of these academics being surveyed, so I received the request from QS to answer their thing. I said, well, what the hell? I'm going to see what it looks like. So you click on the button, you get to this website saying, what are the top 10 universities in the world? It's like, I don't know. And then you have a little button, they say, well, we can show you the top 10 from last year if you want. Guess what? and then they ask globally, and then in your field, and then in your country. So, but it's always the same thing. It's that they're prompting you with last year's thing. And they don't tell you what, you know, what do you judge? I mean, how do you judge? It's reputation. It's like, oh, yeah, I mean, I'm sure, you know, MIT or Harvard in computer science, I wouldn't put them there, but I certainly put MIT. The thing is, you know, you come easily with the top two, three, and after that, you know, I know ETH is good, but Munich is good, we're not bad. So it's very noisy. It's very noisy. Then they have citations per faculty number, student-faculty ratio, which, of course, hits us in France because we have to take all students with a baccalaureate in our universities. And in fact, if you look at the plan for the future Université Paris-Saclay, the undergraduate studies, part of them have been put in a separate institution, the École Universitaire de Premier Cycle. Officially, so we can give them better, you know, support for their studies because there are students who need more help, but also maybe because it means they won't count in those statistics. So student-faculty ratio, international students and international faculty, which is a measure that, I don't know, yes, science is a very international field. How important that is, I don't know. So someone, our friend, again, Mattern, has compared the Shanghai and Times Higher Education rankings, and that was done, I guess, in 2008 as well. And the red arrow is for ETH because he's at ETH, so he was doing the study for ETH. And so you have the Times ranking here, 1 to 100, Shanghai ranking 1 to 100. The R square is 0.63, which is not considered a very good correlation. And you can see, or this is someone that is 30th year is 100. Here we have a 50 that goes down to 100. So well, now for the important stuff, what about France? So in 2008, oh yeah, we love this one because Ulm is even ahead of Polytechnique, and then Ennis Lyon is right there, and then Paris East, and Paris Sud was not even ranked. Now the thing is that for THE, they ask you for your numbers, so if you don't give them the numbers, you're not in the ranking. And in 2020, oh man, what happened here? We got Paris Sciences et Lettres and Sorbonne Université, the top two for France. Polytechnique has gone down from rank 34 to 93. ENS is gone. But ENS is part of, they're in PSL, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Université de Paris. So what's happened here is the regrouping of universities that I was talking about has worked because, you know, now we have these three big universities that are at the top. École Polytechnique is merging into something called IPP, so they probably will go be going up. And once Paris Sud, which is sort of way down there, has merged with Paris Saclay, it's expected to be also in the top 100. But a lot of this has to do with the reputation thing. And in fact, I know that for many years, people did not even know Université Paris Sud. A lot of people, journalists, would call it Université d'Orsay. Didn't even know that the university was called Paris Sud. Sorbonne is always a name that is associated with France. So if you ask about, well, what's the best university in France? Well, it has to be the Sorbonne, even though you know you don't even know what they're doing. And so the thing is that if you're not happy with the ranking, you can create your own. And so here's another ranking that is really great for France. So this one has HEC, business school, ranked 7 in the world, ENA, École Nationale d'Administration, 10th, Politics Institute of Paris, 11th, Polytechnique, 15, mean 20, INSEAD 27. I mean, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 French school in the top 27.
How can they compare schools that don't do the same thing?
Well, that's not a problem. You can always put numbers and add them up. Well, so guess who did that? This is the mean Paritech ranking. And so their criteria, and I'm sorry if you don't read French, their main criteria is the number of alumni that are CEO or equivalent in the top 500 companies worldwide. And that's the thing I love, is they say, well, this is really the equivalent for us, for companies, of the criteria used by the Shanghai ranking, of how many alumni got a Nobel Prize or a Fields Medal. Now, it's true that French business schools are very popular internationally, but it's all to say that, you know, you can always make the ranking you want. And in fact, while I was director of LRI, I was, of course, in our evaluation stuff, looking at this, and there's this Webometrics ranking. I don't know if you've come across this one. And I was looking at it, and I'm going to say my lab, because I was head of the lab, so it was my lab at the time, is 97 worldwide in Webometrics. Like, impressive. Now, how do they do this? It's interesting. Well, they look at the number of links towards your website. They look at the sizes of web pages. They look at rich files. So I guess if you put PowerPoints and Excel files, it's better. And Scholar, I don't know exactly what it means. I guess they look at in Google Scholar or something. But still, it was very strange. I mean, CNRS is number 7. INRIA was number 13. But these are massive institutions, right? So I'm not surprised that it would be in the top of the ranking because of their size. Now, the thing is, I investigated that with the staff at LRI, and we discovered that someone had hacked into our website, had put some kind of advertising for, you know, some blue pill or something that was driving in a lot of traffic and a lot of links to this page that had been hacked. And that's how we went to this ranking. And when we took it off, we went down. So sad story. Sad story. And here's the ranking that they do at the international level. So, but to me, this ranking means absolutely nothing. Anyway, just to conclude, because we're running out of time, what do these rankings mean? I think you have to take them with a grain of salt. You have to look at their methodology. You have to compare them. The European Union has been trying to, I was trying to look for the site, which I have stored somewhere, but I couldn't find again. I don't know if he's still alive, but they were going to do a database where they collect data, and then you could decide of how you want to weigh those different indicators and see how things fare for your own measure of things. And that's the thing. It's just data. It's just numbers. If you don't know what's behind them, it's never going to tell you anything interesting. The problem is the media loves ranking. I mean, you know, they rank everything. So ranking of universities, it's like the ranking of the best hospitals to get this type of surgery, like the rankings of, you know, what's the next, what's the best smartphone to buy, or whatever. People love ranking. The problem for us, especially in France, is that policymakers love them as well. And more that the public funding going into research has been put into question. And so they want to know how many bang for the buck they're getting. And this is why university management has started to look into this as well, because they realized that it was important. Some national evaluation agencies, in France we have this thing called HCERS, use those rankings. Now, in places like the UK, a lot of the evaluation is just based on rankings and numbers of publications, numbers this, number of that, completely sort of quantitative without looking at the work actually being done. I think the system we have in France is more balanced. I've been on these committees. Yes, you look at, you know, who are the best researchers in this lab and how they fare, but you also look at the work being done. For some time, the French evaluation agency was grading the labs A+, A, B, or C, and the universities were using this to decide the funding that was going into the lab. With an interesting question is, should you put more money into the best ones, who typically don't have problem getting funding, or should you try to help the less good ones to become better? That's an interesting policy question. But we've also, as higher education is getting more and more international, prospective students and faculty looking for places to be applying to are also looking into this ranking, which is why I was asking the question at the very, very beginning. So this is, in a sense, important, but we should, you know, be able to step back and take into account the fact that a lot of these numbers come from noisy sources. When you get impact factors with three digits after the decimal point, you can wonder if this is a level of precision that makes any sense for the measure in question. Are the measure relevant? Do you do better if you have more international faculty in a university? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it's just non-correlated. And the most important one, I think, is to keep in mind that every time you add measures to a system, you modify the system, and people will change their behavior according to these new measures. Okay, so now to just wrap this up, correlation between rankings and indices, because that's another thing, is we talked about how to measure research output, papers, publications. We talked about the ranking of universities. Are these correlated? Our friend Mattern did that as well. He found a correlation of 0.22, which is really bad, between the peer evaluation-based quality rating of the Netherlands computer science groups, which was done in the Netherlands, and the citation impact indicators of their papers. So that's just to say there's a lot of noise in the system, and we need to look at more than one number. I encourage you, if you're interested in these topics, reading this article by Peter Lawrence, The Mismeasurement of Science. Do you know a book by Stephen Jay Gould, The Mismeasure? It's a mismeasure of man, I think. So he's an anthropologist who's looked at how people over the years have tried to assess intelligence, human intelligence. Right? Peaking with the IQ, the QI, quotient intellectuel, invented by a French, Binet, not to measure the intelligence of kids, but to detect the kids that needed more help in their early years, but that was then used, especially first by the US Army, to rank intelligence and say, well, you know, you're here or there, and therefore. your life is determined. It was so in this book, he's explaining how in the early days, before this IQ test, people were doing things like you take the skull of someone who's dead, preferably, and you put sand in it to measure the volume of the brain. Yeah, volume of the brain. And at the time, this was done, it was in the 18th century, I think, that was done to prove that, of course, people of color were less intelligent than white people. And he's explaining that, you know, when they were measuring the brain of a white person, they took the sand and sort of piled it up. And then when taking the brain, the skull of someone of color, they just pour some sand and, you know, quickly pour it over, just how your predisposition on the result affects the way you measure things. So The Mismeasure of Man is a very good book to read, and that's a reference, this mismeasurement of science, to this book by Stephen Jay Gould. But he's talking about measuring a system affects it, about how easy it is to manipulate the measures, as I've shown a little bit with the impact factors, and how publishing practices evolve quickly to adapt to this changing environment. The second point I want you to take away is all of these things are defined by power laws, laws of rarity. Very impactful papers are rare. Very impactful people, labs are very rare. So how do you make public policy to make based on rare events? That's a very difficult problem. You have the same problem in a completely different topic with, you know, airplane accidents are very rare. So how do you put safety measures for these things that are rare not to happen? Here we want the opposite. We want these things to happen, but it's the same inherent problem. Prediction is difficult, and the causality links are very hard to trace. Why did someone that invented an LED that didn't work then became the laser and the CD and all that? Sometimes you just don't know. So we want to fund research even if there's no immediate direct impact, because sometimes the most important inventions come out of that. And so take these rankings and indices for what they are. And I would finish by saying, look deeper than just these numbers. So these are slides that were done, again, when I was head of the lab by Jean Daniel of the InfoVis group, Jean Daniel Fekett. This was the, 12 groups that there were at the lab at the time, with people in each group against people, and that's the graph of co-publication. So two people in one of these matrix published together if there is a dark cell, published only one paper, or one or two, I think, if it's white, and more than two if it's dark. So you see co-publication inside each group, and then between groups it's done with those links. So you get a sense of who's collaborating with whom. And that gives you a richer picture, of course, of what's going on. You can see some groups that are tighter than others. And another visualization he created was this other graph of co-publication, completely as a graph here. But this one I find a little bit more misleading. For example, you see this thing here, which is like, what's happening here? Well, this is, in fact, one paper with many authors, and so they are each... it's a fully connected graph, but it represents only one paper, so it's, I think, a less... well, it still shows you clusters, but harder to read than the other one. But just two examples just to show, and since then there has been a number of papers published that have looked at a particular field. There's one on InfoVis that is really good, showing, you know, what the evolution of publications have been over the years, who's publishing with whom, etc. And I think these are more interesting, or at least should complement just looking at someone's H&X, impact factor, or ranking. And I'll stop here. Any questions? You want to add something, Anastasia?
This is great.
When is it going to be the University of France?
And the University of France. Well, I don't think we're going to have the University of Paris anytime. Well, there is a University of Paris, but it's not going to be the University of all of Île-de-France. I think what we are seeing for Paris-Saclay is the idea of Paris-Saclay is also to have within Paris-Saclay the University of Versailles and Évry. And to me, if there's no unity of geographical site campus, it's a bit strange, and I don't know how this is going to work with already these three sites. You have the situation in many cities in France. I mean, I studied in Toulouse, and so you have one university in the center of the city, another one suburb, the other one the opposite. So it's hard to get these things to work together. I don't think bigger is necessarily better, and I don't think we should be driven by things like rankings, even though they play a role. But I think in France it had gone to a point where it was really too small and too... I mean, here on this campus, you know, Paris Sud has been sitting next to Polytechnique for, Polytechnique arrived in the 70s, right? So for 50 years now. And I know for being here for more than 30, that, you know, we were always looking at Polytechnique like, you know, we don't want to do anything with them, or the other way around, for that matter. Now they're doing their own thing, but the fact that this project has attracted what used to be ENS Cajon, Centrale Supélec, Telecom, even though they're on the other side, I think it's for the better, because we see the value of mixing students, of having close collaborations with our colleagues, and being in the same organization helps. But making it bigger just for the sake of being bigger or gaining two slots in the ranking, I don't think is a good move. Whether we can get the economies of scale that people expect, I'm not so sure, because when you make things bigger, you have a tendency to centralize, and centralizing can make you save money by having, you know, maybe less staff to manage things. But it means also it's further away from the lab, which is where the action is for research. And so it's a difficult balance.
It's also the question of reputation, right? All these new names that appear and disappear actually between years. This doesn't let you get an international reputation quickly. Our affiliations have been changing the last few years all the time. So, you know, all of these rankings that are based on subjective measures from international colleagues, until they kind of figure out, you know, that this is where this all these people are, etc., it will take some time. So it's not going to be immediate in any case.
Yeah.
So I was wondering what do you think is a good way to rank the universities, as you disagree with the actual ranking? Or do you even think that it's not necessary to rank universities?
Well, so I'll tell you something. When we accept students in this master's or the HCID master's, one of the things that we look at is what university the student is coming from. So we can sort of assess what the grades of that student in that university could compare to others. Instead of having one list or two based on this criteria, I would rather have what the European Union was trying to do, which was the different criteria, so I can make my own mind about which one I want to give weight to. Because, you know, universities is going to take priority, a ranking that's going to use sort of the research output as sort of the main component of their ranking may not be the most relevant if I'm looking for certain types of students. And so what we do is sometimes we take a risk. We have, you know, a student we think, well, you know, this one is super motivated, so we'll get that student, and then we have our own internal ranking that we build over the years. But when it's someone coming from a place we don't know and don't have experience, yes, we'll look at those. So what I would like to do is, yes, have a more nuanced way. So what I do is I look at multiple rankings to see if they are consistent or not and try to make a richer picture.
But personal knowledge is a very important factor here. So, for example, for judging students, we kind of come from different backgrounds, we know different universities, we combine this knowledge, you know, to... if we can, but as Michelle said, this is not always the case.
Okay.
Hey, thank you so much,
Michelle. Well, thank you.
So I will let you know for next week.